dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the scourges in freedom's long-running war with those who wish to take it down has been anti-Semitism. It is, unfortunately, in our time, enjoying a resurgence in not only places like the Middle East, in which it has been evident more often than not, but in Europe, and indeed even in our own country. One of the few people who has spoken authoritatively, and I believe persuasively, about the most important wellspring of anti-Semitism in our time is Dr. Andrew Bostrom. He is, well, a Renaissance man, I believe, the author of a number of extraordinarily impressive volumes about, well, the legacy of jihad, the title of one, the legacy of anti-Semitism, another, Sharia versus freedom, the legacy of Islamic anti-Semitism, and most recently, Iran's final solution for Israel, the legacy of jihad and Shiite Islamic Jew hatred in Iran. There is a leitmotif, if you didn't notice it, folks. He's big on history and legacies, and one of the reasons why we value his appearances here from time to time is he helps bring them to life for us, helps us understand their implications, the historical precedents and impetuses for behavior like anti-Semitism that is important for us to understand if we're to deal with it effectively in our own time. He is the author of countless periodical essays and columns and articles. He is also a research associate professor of family medicine at Brown University. Dr. Bostrom, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Well, I want to start with the legacy, the history, the roots of anti-Semitism as you see them in this era, Andy. Whence does it come from, and who are really its prime practitioners?
Well, unfortunately, it's coming from, as it always has, I believe, from Islam's canonical sources, the Quran, the Hadith, the traditions of Muhammad, and the earliest Muslim biographies of Muhammad, the so-called Sirah. But in this era, I usually like to start with things in terms of quantification. And the Anti-Defamation League did an incredible series of surveys, much to their own chagrin, I believe, between 2014 and 2017. They established an instrument. I don't mean to sound too epidemiological about this, but they basically surveyed 11 sort of classic anti-Semitic stereotypes and gauged agreement with at least 6 out of the 11, and applied this scale across the world and established if you agreed with 6 out of 11 of these anti-Semitic stereotypes or more, you were considered a case of extreme anti-Semitism. Then they established the prevalence of this in all the populations that they surveyed. And they literally did this worldwide. It was called the ADL Global 100. And the results were quite striking, published over a period of 3 years between 2014 and 2017. The world's 16 most anti-Semitic countries were all in the Muslim Middle East, where a rather staggering 74% to 93% exhibited this extreme anti-Semitism. And again, that's the ADL definition of extreme anti-Semitism. Globally, by religious affiliation, it was, again, disproportionately a Muslim phenomenon. 49% amongst Muslims, 24% amongst Christians, no religion, 21%, Hindus, 19%, Buddhists, 17%. They moved on to Western Europe, surveyed a number of countries. The overall prevalence of extreme anti-Semitism within the Muslim communities was between 49 to 68%, average of 55%, I believe. versus 12 to 29% amongst non-Muslims. So again, a 2 to 4.5-fold excess. And then they finally reached the United States, Frank. And here, we're a much more philo-Semitic country, but the prevalence of extreme anti-Semitism amongst Muslims already by 2017 was 34% versus only 14% of the general population. So very consistent 2.4-fold excess.
So, Andy, you're saying that this is not any longer confined to any particular region. And I think it's fair to say there are others who practice anti-Semitism historically before there was Islam. You know, there were Christians who were anti-Semites because they believed that Jews killed Christ and for whatever other reason. But what you're describing in our time in terms of its virulence, in terms of its intensity, in terms of its, well, proliferation, is that people who embrace what I think of as Sharia, as kind of the distilled essence of Islam, the doctrine that animates jihad and so much more, have plenty of guidance from their sacred texts, from Sharia itself, for anti-Semitic attitudes and conduct. Is that right?
Absolutely. And what I did to illustrate this recently at this talk that I gave for the ZOA.
That would be the Zionist Organization of America. And I'm glad you mentioned it because I want people to know how they can see the full talk, which I believe is of surpassing importance, and commend both your host and a keeper of the flame, as a matter of fact, at the Center for Security Policy, Morton Klein, the president of ZOA, and you, of course, Andy, for delivering that speech. But how can people check it out?
The full set of slides with the presentation that I gave are available on YouTube, on my YouTube channel, and the ZOA put it out in a release.
Okay, and your YouTube channel is Andy Bostom.
Yeah, I have two YouTube channels. One is Andrew Bostom and one is Andrew G. Bostom.
Check it out, Andrew Bostom. Give us, the essence of your remarks there, if you could, briefly.
So when you look at the last two Grand Imams, the current Grand Imam Al-Tayeb, his immediate predecessor, Muhammad Tantawi, particularly the latter, who was a giant amongst modern Quranic scholars, he produced not only a full Quranic commentary, but a 700-page treatise devoted to the Jews, which translates as Jews in the Quran and the traditions. And he says the Quran describes the Jews with their own particular degenerate characteristics, killing the prophets of Allah. He gives the Quranic citations, corrupting his words by putting them in the wrong places, other ugly characteristics. And he goes on to say, only a minority of Jews keep their words. The good ones become Muslims. That's Quran 3:113. And he also goes on to sanction violence. And this was particularly disturbing. He says one may go so far as to ban their religion, their persons, their wealth, and their villages. And this is to, quote, rid them of their evil.
Andy, we're going to have to drill down on this on the other side of a short break. I want to make sure we fix where this Grand Imam operates from, what authority he has, and why we ignore what he says and what is in Sharia with respect to anti-Semitism at our own peril, not with regard to you being Jewish or otherwise. It speaks enormously to the danger that the Sharia supremacists represent to all of us. We'll be right back with much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We have the pleasure of a second segment with Dr. Andrew Bostom to discuss the wellspring in Islam's Sharia doctrine of anti-Semitism, and what it means both for Jews and for non-Jews, that this is a practice that is very much enshrined in that doctrine, not to say that all Muslims practice Islam according to Sharia or want to live under it or would embrace its teachings, but an awful lot of them do. And he describes some of the data that specifically translates into the adherence to this anti-Semitism program. But Andy, you mentioned not one but two grand imams, and I wanted you to explain why they have that distinction, where they work from, and what the implications of their status in Islam is for the sorts of teachings, the anti-Semitic promoting teachings you've described.
Well, so Grand Imam Tantawi, who passed in 2010, was the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar University, which is really the Vatican of Sunni Islam, and has been for about 1,000 years now. And so he gives the highest, certainly Sunni authoritative imprimatur to these ideas. And moreover, just as a scholar, he's perhaps modern Sunni Islam's greatest Quranic commentator. He set up a website that has translated now over 100, or has put on in the original Arabic, over 100 classical tafsirs, which span 1,000 years. So he's really an authoritative figure.
And tafsirs being?
Quranic commentaries, I'm sorry. And he was also a public figure who weighed in to interfaith dialogue, was very, very negative in terms of the interfaith dialogue with Israel's chief rabbi. He talked about putting a stick in his eye and reminding him that he believed in everything published in his dissertation. That was a quote I gave you before from his dissertation. But even after the Netanya homicide bombing, that gruesome event on March 27, 2002, he came out proclaiming the legitimacy of homicide bombing of Jews. He condemned Jews as apes and pigs per Quran 560. And so he stayed pretty hardened in his attitudes. His successor is just as bad. Ahmed Al-Tayeb gave an interview. And remember, he was the number one ranked Muslim figure for 2017 in this thing that comes out every year, the Muslim 500. But he gave a very quick very quick commentary on Quran 582. It's a central verse which declares the Jews as the strongest among men in enmity to the Muslims. And he said it's an historical perspective which has not changed to this day. See how we suffer from global Zionism and Judaism. Since the inception of Islam 1,400 years ago, we have been suffering from Jews and Zionist interference in Muslim affairs. And, you know, that was his connection, was to Quran 582. But the problem is, Frank, that not a single religious figure, not a single political figure condemned these remarks. I was fortunate enough to be in contact with Geert Wilders at the time, whom we both know.
Dutch parliamentarian.
Yes, and asked Pope Francis to condemn these remarks as well, but of course he didn't. You know, since that point, Tayeb has blamed the Jews and global Zionism for jihad terror in the Middle East, including the rise of ISIS. He's claimed that the Jews want to march on the Meccan Kaaba, you know, the holy site in Mecca, that the Hajj pilgrims circle. They want to attack the Islam's the Prophet's mosque in Medina. And then he goes on to say that the issue of anti-Semitism is a lie that continues to deceive nations to this day. So, I mean, this is the living papal equivalent.
Well, and Andrew, this is, as always, very provocative stuff, what you're saying. And one of the reasons why I value your participation in this program is I know you've done your homework, the research. You're able to document chapter and verse. And I think one of the reasons why this very formidable presentation you made in July to the Zionist Organization of America really is required viewing is that, you know, it's all there, you know. It's not take your word for it. It's not you popping off with some theory. It is carefully and clinically, if I can use that expression, doctor, researched and documented. So this brings us to the challenge that we face in this time. And that is that essentially no one but you and Mort Klein and a few others of us are calling attention to this causal connection between Islam's teachings in Sharia and much of the world's anti-Semitism. And I wanted to ask you, Andy, both to talk about what seems to be happening. You describe the silence from Pope Francis, for example, and other political leaders with respect to this Grand Imam. But we have an even more immediate example, more sort of in-our-face example of that in connection with what Representative Ilhan Omar has been doing since she came to the United States Congress to represent the people of Minnesota in terms of her overt expressions of anti-Semitic sentiment, both, you know, that from her own colleagues, including the Democratic leadership of the House of Representatives and members of the press, academics, even, I'm shocked to say, some Jewish organizations in this country. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, I don't forget Rashida Tlaib, who is at least as virulent. So she has a cohort in this in Congress. I think the Jewish community was identified in a very good interview Yigal Carmon, the director of Memory, gave back in February.
That's the Middle East Media Research Institute.
Yes, that the Jewish community is paralyzed by fears of being labeled Islamophobic. And he exactly brought up this example. He said there was no protest, no public activity. And he also condemned American Jewish community for not saying anything in particular about the horrific mosque sermons that Memory monitors and frequently translates or presents them in English if they're presented in English.
Indispensable service.
Yeah, this was going to lead to a state of affairs that was comparable to what's going on in Western Europe, where the Jews are literally under siege if people remain paralyzed by their fears. Now, I will say I was struck within the last couple of weeks by a remarkable interview that Representative Mo Brooks gave, the congressman from Alabama, where he just laid it right on the line that the basis for Tlaib and Omar's anti-Semitism, he identified them both was coming from Islam's religious texts, and that it was going to create a very, very untenable situation for Jews in the Democratic Party, and then potentially more widely. I thought this was incredibly courageous for Congressman Brooks to say.
Well, and the reason that it's so courageous is, as you and I can both attest, the costs associated with speaking truthfully about these facts can induce not just this branding as Islamophobic, but the most virulent kinds of ad hominem, personal, reputational attacks and harm. And so, yes, hats off to Congressman Brooks, but also to you, my friend. And I think to all of those who are currently being wrongly depicted as haters and racists and bigots. And I'm sorry to say I'm among those, but the main thing is that we desperately need this sort of truth-telling. You're a medical doctor. You know better than anybody, Andy Bostom, that you can't cure a disease if you can't properly diagnose it, right?
Exactly. And I think that we can calmly, and by the way, Mo Brooks presented his arguments very calmly and rationally. But I think that if we can just get out what these institutional centers of religious education in Islam are actually saying and publishing, I think that's very, very important, because it's, unfortunately, Frank, it's the Shia as well. And I gave an example of that in my recent ZOA talk, that it's no different. And we're not talking about marginal figures. We're not talking about radicals. We're not talking about jihadist organizations or political organizations within these countries, within Iran, within Egypt, for example. We are literally talking about their Vatican equivalents. And that is a phenomenon that is clearly unique to Islam, and I think is logically connected to those ZOA data that we discussed at the beginning. I mean, I don't see what other encompassing rational explanation there is for such a broad and disproportionate phenomenon.
Well, again, this is a clinical diagnosis by a trained medical professional. You're not just a medical professional, obviously. You're a deeply, deeply knowledgeable historian and forensic, analyst of these sorts of issues. Andy, I regret to say we are hard out of time. This is a topic to which we will return soon, but thank you for your courage, your clarity, your knowledge, your willingness to teach the rest of us about these forces at work that are such a threat to Jews, yes, obviously, and the state of Israel, but I believe also to the rest of us who love freedom in this war for the free world. God bless you, sir. Come back to us again soon, if you will. David Goldman joins us next. We'll talk with him about China, the threat it poses, among other things, right after this.
Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It is my delight to say, joined as we have the privilege of being, and I really mean that, the privilege of being each week by David Goldman. He is a Renaissance man, one of the smartest fellows that I have come across, and his writings, his commentaries, his speeches, his visits with us are always worth taking aboard and seriously assessing for their insights as well as sometimes their unconventional wisdom. It's a delight, as I said, to have him with us. David is prominently an author of How Civilizations Die and an extraordinary column at the Asia Times under the byline Spengler. David, it's good to have you back as always. Welcome.
Oh, it's my pleasure entirely, Frank. Thanks so much for the kind words.
Well, they're heartfelt and deserved. Let me just ask you, if I could, to talk about an issue that you spend a lot of time thinking about, in particular from the vantage point of somebody who is in finance and in business and in Asia a lot. Mark Esper, the new Secretary of Defense, addressed the Naval War College this week, talking to future leaders of our military and other militaries as well about having now entered an era of great power competition, as he puts it. And it was pretty clear from the tenor of his remarks that he's very concerned about our readiness for the kind of competition that he now sees us having with both Russia and China. He recommended, among other things, that we have to be much more present in parts of the world that we have not been, in part to counteract the effects of what the Chinese have been doing with their Belt and Road Initiative, so-called. Your thoughts on the accuracy of that characterization of the problem and the urgency of addressing it in the kinds of ways he's talking about?
Well, I think the Defense Secretary is exactly right to address it. The biggest bombshell that hit the defense world, as I hear the buzz, was a report by a think tank at the University of Sydney, Australia, saying that the United States military is behind the curve technologically, strategically overstretched, and China has moved up the curve so rapidly that its missile force could wipe out most American military assets in Asia within a matter of hours. Now, I know there are people at the Pentagon who shared that view. We know about their surface-to-ship missiles, which are they've characterized as aircraft carrier killers. They bragged about their ability to take down American carriers. This is obviously extremely concerning, add to which the hypersonic missiles, against which there is no present defense, as Mike Griffin, the Undersecretary for Research and Engineering, has warned repeatedly. So we really have our work cut out for us. We have a serious strategic challenge by China, which threatens to push us out of the Asia-Pacific with weapon systems against which we don't have defenses. Now, it's fine to say we should be in a lot of places. The difficulty, the thing that scares me the most, is can we stay in the places where we've had a dominant role since World War II?
Yes. I want to talk to you about that specifically in connection with South Korea. South Korea, of course, as you know so well, and I'm sure our listeners do, has been a linchpin of our presence in Asia and our ability to project power in that region for quite some time, with bases and strong ally there and across the strait and in Japan. President Moon Jae-in has been, it seems to, I think, me and others, increasingly problematic as an ally in that very important part of the world. Notably, his efforts to pursue unification with the North, even on terms that seem pretty much like Kim Jong-un's, and his fracturing of that U.S.-South Korea-Japan relationship and strategic alliance. David, am I wrong in perceiving this as a serious problem? Or if it is, what would you say we should be doing about it?
Well, the most important thing we have to do to impress on the South Koreans that they need us is to remain the strongest power in the Pacific. If they truly believe that China can wipe out the American military in the Pacific and that we're a paper tiger, the Koreans pragmatically...
Yeah, a separate piece.
Absolutely. Their attitude towards the United States is, we know you saved us, we know you created Korean democracy, but what have you done for us lately? We can't count on goodwill. We have to assert power.
David, you, again, follow these things in Asia very closely. Is that the sentiment of the Korean people more generally, or of Kim and his circle, who are known hard leftists and have been sort of inclined in that direction, even when we were unmistakably the preeminent power in the region?
Well, I think the Koreans are extremely frustrated about the present trade dispute between the United States and China and the way the United States has handled China. Their economy is heavily dependent on China. A lot of the Chinese imports that we bring into the United States are assembled out of South Korean parts, and the tariffs hurt them indirectly because their parts are no longer being assembled and shipped to the United States. Korean economy is basically in recession right now. And if you have a combination of a tough trade policy, which hurts them, and a feeble military policy, which doesn't really protect them, that's a toxic combination, and sentiment will turn against us.
Popular sentiment, not just at the elite level.
Oh, absolutely. Moon is a squishy leftist, and I'm very upset that he's the president of Korea, but after all, he was elected.
Yeah. I put a quibble about squishy. I think he's pretty hard. But let's turn to another problematic alliance and very portentous set of implications arising from it, David, in another part of the world that you follow closely too, the Middle East. Turkey, under Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has long since, as far as I'm concerned, ceased to be an ally. It's now becoming increasingly a dangerous force for adversaries of this country, it seems. Among other examples one might look to, in Moscow recently, he was seen to be casting an interested eye in one of the new fifth-generation Russian aircraft, presumably because he can't buy the F-35 from us, having bought their S-400 air defense system. What is Erdogan up to in this regard and others that should be a very considerable concern to us as well?
Erdogan is acting in a very clever way. He's making himself look indispensable to everybody. So the Pentagon is bending over backwards to be nice to him. We gave him this security zone, which he demanded in northern Syria, which allows him to push the Kurds out. And the Kurds, of course, have been our boots on the ground defeating ISIS, which has led to something of a resurgence in ISIS. I think that's a mistake, and I've had long arguments with many of my friends in Washington, like my friends at Hudson Institute, who are, you know, cheering this pro-Turkey policy at the Defense Department, which I don't really understand. At the same time, although he's got major differences with Russia, Russia's backing the Assad regime. The Assad regime is involved in a war on the ground with Turkish forces versus pro-government forces. Russia, as usual, plays all sides and would love nothing more than to make Turkey dependent on Russian military hardware. So Turkey, and of course, he's playing games with Iran on the side, helping Iran to break the American boycott by smuggling gold and any number of other things. So Erdogan is exploiting the ambiguity and unclarity of American policy in the Middle East to maximize his power. And the scariest thing, Frank, is he's now talking about developing nuclear weapons. There are many serious defense experts, particularly in Europe, who don't think he's bluffing.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it's the nature of these things now that if you want such weapons, you can get them. You may even be able to simply buy them outright if you don't want to go through the expensive and cumbersome and time-consuming and often fraught exercise of, you know, building the infrastructure necessary to manufacture them your own. Right.
Absolutely. Here's the bigger dilemma, Frank. The president understandably wants to reduce American boots on the ground in the region. He doesn't want American casualties. America's self-sufficient in oil. He thinks other people should take care of their own energy security. But at the same time, to the extent that we are viewed as being disinterested, ready to leave the region, other people and some very bad actors will move in. And the main actor that will move into the Middle East is the country that's most dependent on Middle East oil, which, of course, is China.
Oh, indeed. To this point, I think you were specifically referring to Syria, which is a vacuum waiting to be filled, and our forces coming out of there would exacerbate it. But it is true in spades, it would seem, of Afghanistan as well. And our friend Yigal Karmon at the Middle East Media Research Institute has written a very interesting and, I think, timely piece about what he calls the trap that Qatar has set for us by nurturing these talks with the Taliban, which, according to some reports, have now produced a document that the president may well embrace, but it would, I believe, be tantamount to a surrender in Afghanistan. David Goldman, from your perspective, how is that likely to be perceived by other friends of this country and those that are particularly susceptible to making separate pieces with other great powers instead of relying on us?
Remember that Qatar is Turkey's biggest ally, biggest financier. Turkey's building a giant military base in Qatar, has soldiers deployed there to protect them. Turkey, meanwhile, has been bailed out of their financial crisis by China, is becoming effectively a Chinese ally. They've turned a blind eye to the incarceration of a couple of million Turkic Muslims in China, the Uyghurs, in order to curry Chinese favors. So you can see a new configuration developing where between Turkey, Qatar, and Iran, China will remotely exercise enormous influence, and that will eventually prepare the way for a serious Chinese naval deployment to become the guarantor of oil security in the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, among other power projection options. David Goldman, alas, we are out of time. Thank you for your work at, among other places, the Asia Times. Come back to us again next week, if you would. Next up, we'll be speaking with Kevin Freeman. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We have the privilege once again of having as a guest a regular, Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, specializing in economic warfare. He's one of the country's real leading experts on the subject, as you can ascertain from following him at his Blaze TV television program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Find out how to get it at economicwarfare.com. Also, his blog site, globaleconomicwarfare.com. And, of course, his two superb books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. Kevin, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's at globaleconomicwarfare.com and economicwarroom.com are the two websites.
Thank you. I get them bollocksed continuously. Check them out is the point, folks. Let's start, Kevin, with some China-related developments. We were just talking about China with David Goldman. A message came across my email this morning, someone who had a friend in Taipei doing a stopover there, and as happens, a message popped up on his cell phone from his carrier T-Mobile that was welcoming him to Taiwan, a province of China. That's not exactly right, and it's a very interesting, I think, insight into how China is using its influence with companies. And then we'll talk about several aspects of that. But what are your thoughts in response to this particular anecdote?
Well, you're correct. It's not right, but it's also not surprising. This is a part of Chinese ongoing influence operations. They bribe, threaten, cajole, do everything they can to get the Chinese view pushed out to the world. And they've done that with the Confucius Institutes here, and they've bribed scholars. And it just is appalling, but it is not surprising.
To the extent that it is symptomatic of what's happening, there's a lot of talk at the moment that despite their desire, obviously, to curry favor with the Chinese, a number of companies, American and others, who have heretofore been relying on supply chains in China are now moving out, switching horses, if you will. Do you see evidence that that is happening on a significant scale at this point, Kevin? And what is impelling it? And what are the likely consequences of those changes?
Well, those who have done business in China for quite some time, in many, many cases, have found that their intellectual property is stolen. They found that they've been under control and manipulation from the government and so forth. And as a result, there's a large and growing distrust from American companies. I remember 20 years ago, we were talking to people that were putting manufacturing or semiconductors and other things in China, and they found that they were being taken advantage of, and now they are the strongest China hawks that exist. So American companies are especially doing business there, are interested in seeing alternatives, and the economics support that because China is becoming more and more expensive and Vietnam and other places are offering better alternatives. And then you have the potential backlash of the Trump administration. So it is, the handwriting is on the wall, but in both directions, this is a global economic war. We're fighting a war here.
Yeah. But one of the considerations, of course, is they're also, by being in China, compelled to give up or simply have stolen intellectual property. And I guess for many of these companies, Kevin, it just hasn't worked out that they've had the kind of access to this vast Chinese market that they thought would be forthcoming. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So the Chinese are using influence in a variety of ways, and to the extent that it's not keeping people from shifting gears in that way, all the better. In particular, I'm very hopeful, Kevin, that one of the changes that's going to be made is something that a mutual friend of ours to whom you introduced me, as a matter of fact, Rosemary Gibson, has been pointing out the threat specifically arising from our reliance on supply chains in China for medicines, for antibiotics, for components of prescription drugs of various kinds, penicillin, vitamin C even. Do you see that beginning to change as well? Because it is so clearly fraught in terms of, public safety, public health, as well as the national security.
Well, China has used the classic cartel monopoly type strategy to run competitors out of the business. They bankrupted all of the supplement manufacturers that made vitamin C and so forth here and gave them the economic incentive to shift overseas to production in China. And now they control something that's critical to our future. The problem is it's obscured to the American people. We're not aware that most of our drugs have a Chinese component, if not being made entirely in China. We're not aware of the health risks that have resulted from that Rosemary so well points out. For example, heparin and how people died because they used tainted pig intestines to make heparin, and Americans had no idea. The Center for Disease Control had to find that out after the fact because we don't inspect the plants in China. The FDA doesn't go regularly as they do with American companies. So this is awareness is the critical component here. I have not seen the drug companies themselves make the moves that they need to make, but with public awareness, I believe that they will.
Well, we need the awareness for sure, and we appreciate, of course, what you've done at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, among other places, to highlight this cause, as we have tried to do as well with our Committee on the Present Danger, China. Let me ask you about another growing problem in the economic warfare space, Kevin Freeman, and that is we've recently learned that not only have the Chinese penetrated our capital markets big time in vehicles like the Morgan Stanley MSCI index, but that they're poised to do so with respect to something called the Thrift Savings Plan. Remind us what that is and as you see it, what the dangers would be should that happen.
Well, the Thrift Savings Plan is a federally run program that manages investments and pensions for federal employees. And they have, you know, a huge, it's one of the largest plans. I think it's, you know, $500 billion or something in size. And they recently decided that they were going to move to the MSCI All Country World Index. There's this huge trend in investing. We'll just put it in the index. We can't pick stocks. The problem with that is the Chinese have gamed the index in such a way that the amount of money going to China will quadruple in the next weighting. Index weighting change. And so this means an enormous amount of money is going from American, patriotic, federal employee money going to be funding
military
the Chinese
personnel.
Agenda.
Yeah, past and present. This is unbelievable, Kevin. And I'm hopeful that with the leadership of people like Marco Rubio and Democratic Senator Gene Shaheen and Jim Banks, a member of Congress, and others, we'll see this, Newt Gingrich has recently written about it, this decision reversed. It's unconscionable, irresponsible, and downright dangerous for the national security for us to be increasing our underwriting of Chinese companies that are engaged in activities deeply, deeply dangerous to our nation.
Yeah, it's not hard to separate out. You could do the MSCI All Countries World Index ex-China. And that would send a stark message. That would be a powerful message.
Presumably to the capital markets more generally, not just to those companies. Let me just ask you about one other thing. Against this backdrop, Kevin, the Chinese are working, as you've described so brilliantly in so many different places, across the broadest possible front. It's a full-spectrum war against us, economic, of course, especially. But I'd like to ask you about influence operations as a backdrop to what we've been discussing with companies and with cap market indexes and the like. There's something apparently called a whitelist, according to a fellow by the name of Isaac Stone Fish, who writes for the Washington Post. What's up with that, and how does it play in all of this?
Well, essentially, the Chinese have a list where they offer special treatment either to get in and out of China or information or potentially contracts and other inducements if you say nice things about China. if you say bad things about China, I've got to tell you, Frank, you're on the blacklist.
Oh, big time.
And all of the members of the Committee on the Present Danger, but there's a list of people that they support and that they provide special favors to. And that's a very dangerous strategy.
Well, and it affects what academics and former government officials and businessmen do, because if their livelihood depends or could certainly benefit from getting access to China, it's going to affect behavior for sure. Thank you, Kevin Freeman, as always, for your insights on so many of these topics. Come back to us again next week, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.